Okay, Erev Tov, Shavua Tov. Welcome, everybody. I just want to briefly go over the format for the evening. We have three wonderful speakers and I think an important discussion. What we're going to do is each of our three rabbis is going to speak for 7 minutes on the issues they see from their own personal view facing the modern Orthodox community. After that, they're going to have an internal discussion among themselves. We can all listen, and we'll see how long that will go, and then we're going to open up the floor to the floor for questions. So if the rabbis would like to take a seat on the panel, Vakasha. And for two reasons, we're going to call on Rabbi Korobkin to go first. Potchim b'chvod Aksanya, the host of the evening, the host shul for the evening, and of course, going alphabetically, K comes before R and S. So without further ado, we'll ask Rabbi Korobkin to give us approximately 7 minutes to sum up all the issues facing modern Orthodoxy. It's like Hillel on one foot. Bakasha, thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. First of all, Shavua Tov, everybody. For those of you who were here, I hope you had a beautiful Shabbos for the Shabbos project. For those of you who were at Shari Shamayim, or I hope you had a wonderful Shabbos with Rav Riskin.
We did.
It is a tremendous. And for those of you who were at neither shul, I'm sorry.
It's an amazing morning. It's for no
administration. It is a tremendous honor to once again host Rav Riskin here at the Bayit as sort of an adjunct to his Shabbaton at Shari Shamayim. And I thank Rabbi Strauchler for my dear colleague and friend, Rabbi Strauchler, who is a man of great character and great vision, who immediately thought of the possibility of not only keeping Rav Riskin down south, but also allowing us to work together and have a community discussion about some very large issues. And so thank you, Reb Chaim, for that. And it's an honor to have you here as well. For those of you who were here, the Shabbos Project is an amazing phenomenon. It crosses denominations. And it is something that has an appeal to people who are right-wing Orthodox, modern Orthodox, not Orthodox at all. And so there's still a tremendous afterglow in our community because our community is extremely diverse. Baruch Hashem, one of the strengths of the Bayit, and perhaps sometimes a weakness, but I think mostly its strength, is that it is comprised of so many different stripes and colors within the Orthodox spectrum. And so while it's true that so many of our kehila identifies as modern Orthodox, and the hashkafa that we extol is definitely certainly in the modern Orthodox realm because of our emphasis on religious Zionism, on Medinat Israel, on integration and drawing the best things that the secular world has to offer to ourselves and our children. At the same time, it extends beyond that. And so I'm not sure, really, if I'm the right person to begin this conversation about what the challenges facing modern Orthodoxy are. But I will start off with the following. I know that our speakers are going to be talking about different things. One of the things that struck me was an article that came online about 6 days ago. It was an article called Modern Orthodoxy from a Teenager's Perspective. If you've read the article, raise your hand. I'm just curious how many of you have seen it. Quite a few have seen it. It was in the Times of Israel blog, and that's the great thing of Times of Israel, is that anyone has a voice. And this is a young man who really basically called out his own community in a very respectful way. But nonetheless, his point was that as kids, he says, we are proactively exposed to media and entertainment that is anti-religious and contrary to halacha. And whereas perhaps maybe in our generation, I'm including myself in our generation, we also had things that were anti-religious and counter halacha. But I think that it was a little bit easier to maneuver because you knew, what's that line from All in the Family? Girls were girls and men were men, right? In the good old days, everyone knew who they were, and today it's much more confusing. Today there's modern technology and there's an exposure to a whole gamut of things. You know, when my son was 7 years old, he knew what it meant to be gay. I didn't know what that concept even meant, I think, until I was in my late teens. Maybe I was more sheltered than other people, I don't know, but I don't think so. I think just that the world has changed and our children are exposed to so much more. And this was really a call for help from this young man saying, listen, we know more about secular culture than we know about Torah. And you know, the way he says, modern Orthodox teenagers can tell you who Kobe, Jay-Z, or even Shakespeare is, but very few will know Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky or Rabbi Herschel Schachter, and if I might add, Rabbi Riskin as well. And that's a problem, he says. And he says, modern Orthodoxy tries to create a balance. But he says, that balance at the moment cannot work because we have no drive to be with Hashem, and we lack the philosophical and hashkafic perspective to articulate why we should be Jewish in a world with an assortment of other options. It's an extremely insightful statement. I was just in my son's yeshiva in Lev HaTorah this past week in Beit Shemesh, and we had a session with the boys. They wanted to have a Q&A with a pulpit rabbi. And so one of the things that I said to the boys, if you want to be a leader of the Jewish people, which I call upon you all to be, I said, it's going to be important for you to be able to just write for yourself in your mind a very short essay. And that essay has to basically answer the question, why am I Jewish? And the problem is that not enough of our kids are able to answer that question. I don't know if it's an exclusively modern Orthodox problem, but I think that because our children in a modern Orthodox community are more exposed to the external culture, the answer to that question for them needs to be, for us, is much more pressing and is much more necessary. And I think that it starts in our schools and it starts in our homes. Unfortunately, the school systems are starting to catch up, but there's a long way to go. Our children are not being given the proper tools to answer that very, very basic question. They're getting tremendous tools in learning how to read a Rashi and how to make a laning on a Gemara and how to learn the Meforshim on Chumash and Dinim. But the basic questions of why is something that remains, to a large extent, unanswered. And perhaps one of the reasons is because many of the teachers cannot articulate a proper answer to that question either, so that they can give it to their students. And that's where I think that the problem begins. And there are many other things to discuss, but I don't want to go past my time. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
I believe Rabbi Karapkin is very much correct that the most critical problem facing Judaism today, Jews, especially in the diaspora, but throughout the world, why be Jewish? The intermarriage rate, you all know, in America is 71.2% of 90%. The 10% Orthodox is not within that group. 7/9 are intermarry. Most of them without any kind of significant conversion. So this is a very critical question. Why be Jewish? And I go around the campuses, and this is the question I always ask. I'm going to express one thing, and then I'm going to talk about a number of issues that are germane. But the real answer to the question, why be Jewish, is because we have a mission to change the world. You know, we just began reading Sefer Bereshit after the holiday season. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And the first Rashi asks the question, why does the Torah begin, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The issue should have been, the first thing in the Torah should have been a mitzvah, the first mitzvah that God gave the Jewish people. Because after all, the Torah is a book of commandments. Rashi gives the answer he gives, a very wonderful Zionist answer. I strongly identify with Rashi's answer. But my Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, gave a different answer. He said that Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, that is a mitzvah. It is a commandment. Because the central commandment in the Torah, according to the Rambam and Mor Nevuchim, is v'halachta bidrachav. You must walk in God's ways. Imitatio Dei. We have to try to be like God, not like the animals. And whenever the Torah tells us anything about God, just as He is that He is, the God of love and compassion, we must be people of love and compassion. If the first verse in the Bible is that God created the heavens and the earth, just as God created worlds, we must create worlds. Or to put it a bit differently, recreate God's world. Because God created an incomplete world, a world with darkness as well as light, a world with chaos as well as order, a world with evil as well as good. We must attempt to recreate the world, and as much as we can, first working within our own individual familial worlds, and then if we can go beyond that, as each one according to his ability and opportunity, we must attempt to recreate God's world and make it a more perfect world. This is what we say in Oleinu 3 times a day. L'taken olam b'malchut shakai. To perfect the world in the kingship of God. So why be Jewish? Because we are not to accept the world as it is. We have to try to make the world a better place. Now this is a very important issue, because there are many Jews that don't believe that that's an issue. There are many Jews who quote all the time, "Heinam levadad yishkon uvagoyim lo yitchashav." Behold, we are a unique nation alone, and should have no concern about what the other nations think or do. And we have to live our lives in accordance with the mitzvot of the Torah. That's it. But I think many of our youth, and many of our adults also, don't find that necessarily satisfying. and they understand that Judaism wants more of us. It wants us to change and perfect the world. And God said this to Abraham. We read it this morning. I'll make you a great nation. Through you must be blessed all the families of the earth. Further, Abraham will be a great and mighty people. And God said to Abraham, I have loved you and chosen you because you are commanding your children and household after you. And Abraham's household consisted of all the families of the earth. You must take responsibility for a God of love and his desires for the world and attempt to perfect the world in the kingship of God, to establish compassionate righteousness and moral justice in a world that seems to be antithetical to those two ideals. And I think if we can imbue our people with the mission that we have to make the world a better place in which to live and deal with the issues, that's much more difficult, but deal with the issues that are roundabout and try to show the Jewish moral direction, then we'll go a long way into telling people why they should be Jewish. Now, there are two subsidiary issues that are wreaking havoc with American Jewry. And the situation in Israel is different than the situation in the diaspora. American Jewry, I imagine, is close to Torontonian Jewry, both different from what's happening in Israel. I think the first issue plaguing America, and I imagine Canada as well, but certainly America, is the issue of intermarriage. And the Jewish people are dwindling. 7/9 are intermarried. The Holocaust only took 1/3. This can see the destruction of 7/9. And my family, my response to this, a very strong response, stop seeing it as a tragedy, see it as an opportunity. And we are attempting conversion centers. I find that when you teach Judaism as a mission to make the world a better place, and you teach Judaism as a message of love, you teach Judaism as a message of concentrating on relationships rather than acquisitions, concentrating on human sensitivity and not as mathematics 613, then I believe you can win 2 for the price of 1. And you can make the Jewish partner more Jewish and the Gentile partner Jewish with a very strong feeling about Jewish teachings and Jewish life. And the second issue that I think is very significant within modern Orthodoxy is the place of women and women's spiritual leadership. And certainly I believe it's a very important issue. After all, 51% of our population are women. I believe that Judaism has a whole history of women's spiritual leadership. You remember that Mother Sarah was considered a greater prophetess than was Father Abraham a prophet. And Deborah was a great judge and leader of the Jewish people. So we seem to have a tradition that gives much room for women's leadership. Obviously, there may very well be certain areas in halacha which are not necessarily egalitarian. But I think it's very important for us to develop what we can develop, deny what we must deny, but at the same time, face squarely and give to women a real possibility of expressing themselves spiritual.
There's very little to say after following after Rabbi Riskin. I do want to begin by thanking my colleague, Rav Daniel Karabkin, for opening his bayit, making it all of our bayits this evening. And also just to thank Rabbi Karabkin publicly for the type of leadership he exhibits within the wider GTA community. And it's something that I feel and that my community feels, that to have Rabbi Karabkin as a vital part of our community, he has had tremendous hashpa'ah, not just within the bayit, which I'm sure everyone here feels, but also far beyond. So thank you, Rabbi Karabkin. I don't want to disagree with either Rabbi Karabkin or Rabbi Riskin in terms of their comments, but I want to take a different perspective. And that is to suggest that we have a crisis. And when I say that, I mean that in two ways. Oh, louder. Okay. I believe that we have a crisis. And I mean that in two ways. Number one is that when we look at ourselves, and maybe this is something in our DNA, but we always see problems. And if we look at around this room, if you look at our communities on a given Shabbos, we have found the secret formula for how to survive as Jews in North America. And we take it for granted so that we can worry about all the different crises that we experience. But if you look at the history of Jews in North America, this is really the first time that Jews have a greater population in the next generation without resorting to immigration. That now we have found a way to raise Jewish children who want to be Jewish. And the surveys, the studies, all indicate that this is the case. And of course, and we're speaking now as an Orthodox Jew, as a modern Orthodox Jew, and we cannot look at those surveys and not cry and not express our achrayus for all Jews. But what's going on within our shuls and what's going on within our communities should not be taken for granted. And in that respect, I think it's crucial for us to be able to recognize the crisis. That is, that we run to see the problems without having a little bit of hakarat hatov, and asking ourselves, what are we doing right? And how do we do more of that? But there's another meaning that I believe within the crisis idea. And that is that we need to find motivation within our communities to inspire our young people to continue to give and to feel about their Yiddishkeit, that theirs is something of wonderful meaning. And this is a problem that does not just affect us in North America, but I believe it affects Israel as well, which is that a generation ago, when young Zionists, or two generations ago, were just creating the State of Israel, there was great sense of motivation because you were building something that had to be built. And when Rabbi Riskin went out onto a hilltop and created Efrat, and he said to his Baal Batim, we are going to do something amazing, we're going to create Efrat, they felt inspired. They felt something tremendous. And when Rabbi Riskin led the Jews of New York to fight on behalf of the Jews of Russia or the Jews of Syria, the Jews of New York and the Jews of Canada responded and they said, yes, we need to do something that's going to change the world. What is our crisis like this that's going to inspire our children today? What is our Russian Jewry that's going to be able to unite our people to stand up and say, let them go? And I expressed it this morning when introducing Rabbi Riskin and saying that there are certain types of generations. You have certain Avraham generations in which the task of that generation is to be korei b'shem Hashem in new places that have never heard that word before, to build new institutions, to create cities that have never existed or have not existed for 2,000 years. But then there are other generations that are Yitzchak generations. And those generations also have a crucial part to play in Jewish history, because those generations are able to take the inspiration of an Avraham generation and continue it on. And this is something that we face not just as a modern Orthodox community, not just as a Jewish community, but as people living in the Western world that are suddenly responsible to maintain democracy, to defend democratic institutions when they're not being created for the first time, but must be able to see a future through the challenges that a Yitzchak had to face. How do you protect when you're not building? How do you preserve what is right and just when it's not something new? And I believe that this is the crisis also, that we don't have those same types of crises that are able to inspire our children, that demand building because it's already been built, because we have so many beautiful things around us that we must preserve, maintain, and to make sure that they flourish.
Okay, you're supposed to have an internal discussion, but I'll throw out one question to get the discussion rolling. There was recently a survey done of modern Orthodox Jews, a Nishma survey. Can I have a show of hands? How many people have read the survey? Less than read the article on the teenager. Okay, so this was a survey of over 4,000 modern Orthodox Jews who self-divided themselves into five groups, from open Orthodoxy, liberal Orthodoxy, plain modern Orthodoxy, centrist Orthodoxy, and right-wing Orthodoxy. 41% identify as plain modern Orthodoxy, and it's sort of everybody else is somewhere else. And it was quite a fascinating survey with many very interesting results. It's the largest survey ever done of modern Orthodox Jews, only Americans, not Canadians. It was done in America, but a lot of it applies here. So I just want to start with one question.
We were asked to participate in the survey.
Correct. And I filled it out. I did the survey, but when they issued the results, they wanted to keep it to America. I don't exactly know why, but we were not included in the results.
We didn't participate. I just didn't know who these people were.
Okay. but one of the things I find fascinating is only 64% of people are sure that Torah was given at Sinai. And only 51% believe Torah Shebichtav was given at Sinai. There are approximately another 20% who tend to believe it.
Bichtav or Balpah?
Bichtav was 64% who believe it, and another 20% think they believe it. But at least 10% do not believe it. These are self-identifying modern Orthodox Jews. At the same time, 58% strictly keep Torah HaMishpacha, and 22% mostly keep Torah HaMishpacha. In other words, 80% of the community is more or less keeping Torah HaMishpacha, and half the community doesn't believe in Torah Min HaShemayim, or at least parts of Torah Min HaShemayim. So I really ask, in our schools, what do we do? And when you factor in that 42% of people said the reason they are Orthodox, the number one reason to be Orthodox is community. Mitzvot, 4%. Shabbat, 20%, but by a far margin. So clearly what is uniting our community is a sense of community, but there seems to be a tremendous lack in our fundamentals of faith. What should we do about that? Is that a new problem? Has that always been a problem? So I'd like to get some feedback on that. Rabbi Karofkin, you asked me, so I'm going ahead.
This came up at a meeting that I was at last week amongst some rabbis at the RCA. The first thing that we have to know is who did this, who did the study, who are these people? That's one of the reasons why we, our shul didn't participate, is that the organization just sort of came up from nowhere, this organization Nishma. We don't know the people who are running it. We don't know whether it was scientifically done. We don't know how the data was collated, how the questions were presented. And so I would not invest too much into the results. But to the extent that, I think that I addressed this issue a little bit when we were talking about, you know, Judaism, the whole issue of dogma within Judaism, our principles of faith, is a very, very widely debated issue. One thing that some people are pointing to as a potential threat that is going to have a corrosive effect upon Orthodox Judaism is this fascination with biblical scholarship today. There's even a website that's run by a Hasidic guy who's what we would say in yeshiva, he says a shtickle mudna, because he externally, he's very, very religious, but he runs a website called thetorah.com. And thetorah.com is a website dedicated to articles on biblical scholarship, many of which talk about the different authors of Tanakh, the different authors of the Bible. Now, it used to be that if you were an Orthodox Jew, this was off limits. And all of a sudden, there's this new phenomenon of Orthodox biblical scholarship. And there are many different approaches, none of which to me are particularly satisfying, as far as how to really answer the question of how do you reconcile this. If Torah is min hashamayim, if we were given the Pentateuch, at least at Har Sinai or over the course of the 40 years in the desert, then you can't start pointing to the documentary hypothesis and talk about different authors of Deuteronomy versus Leviticus versus Exodus and so forth. So it's, the issue is very problematic. But when I discussed this with my colleagues, they said to me, you know what? It's all very nice and very interesting, but most of the youth today, they're not even talking about that. Halavai, that should be the biggest problem that we have. I don't think that in the past dogma was a big issue, because the Hamon Am, the general populace, were not such groisa Talmidei Chachamim that we have to start analyzing and picking apart the Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikarim, the 13 principles of faith, and find out what do I believe, what do I not believe. The glue that has held our community together is halacha, the halachic life, a life of mitzvot. And to me, to be quite honest, I would suggest that most of our youth haven't really thought, and most of the adults, to be honest, haven't really given much thought into, let me pore over the things that I say at Yigdal every Friday night. I'm happy, you know, Yigdal is the 13 principles of faith. I have to remind my kehillah of that sometimes, because many times half of the shul, if not more, is talking during Yigdal. And so a couple of times I've had to get up and say, Chevra, we're reciting Maimonides' 13 principles of faith. Isn't this important? Isn't this great? And, maybe, you know.
We don't say it in our shul.
You know, so, right. Yeah.
I kid you not, there was a vote.
I understand.
There was a vote, and they do not say Yigdal.
So, you know, dogma is all very good, but to the extent that we're not really thinking about it so much, I don't find it to be the most pressing issue. The issue becomes when we don't have any anchor in our ikarim, in the things that we are supposed to believe in as Jews, because we haven't spent the time going through some of the basic principles of our faith, this can erode away our halachic practice. And that's the area where we should be concerned. Fine, 50% of the, I don't remember what the figure was, 50% of the people not sure whether they believe in Torah is min hashamayim, but you
Torah
put
it,
Torah Shebal Peh. You're putting on tefillin every day?
Only 75% put on tefillin
every
day.
Okay, or are you davening? Are you Shomer Shabbos? Are you eating kosher food?
Okay.
I mean, I think those are the main issues. We still need to make sure that we can answer the question, why am I Jewish? Why be Jewish? And that if we have a basic framework of, I believe that something happened at Har Sinai, God communicated at Har Sinai what he wants of his people. In order for that to be concrete, we can't just rely on the text of the Bible because there's too much vagary there. And so there must have been an accompanying Torah Shebaal Peh, an oral explanation of those mitzvot. And once you have that, you have a workable principle of dogma that can allow you to be a halachic Jew. I don't think that there is much more that is necessary from that perspective of Torah min ha-shamayim, Torah Shebaal Peh min ha-shamayim. But the issue of why be Jewish, that still remains the main thing. Rabbi?
I very, very much agree with Rabbi Karapkin. I think, first of all, I don't believe in Torah Mesinai. I don't think anybody believes in Torah Mesinai. If I remember the Gemara in Gittin Samach Aleph, the machloket in the Gemara is whether the Torah was given Megillah Megillah or Chatumah at the end of Moses' life. I don't think anybody really believes that the entire Torah was given at Sinai. Nobody says that in the Gemara. Now, I also think it's very important to realize that the Rambam's 13 principles were never accepted by Klal Yisrael. Immediately, Rav Yosef Albo wrote another book with 3 principles of faith against the Gemara. It's not so simple, this issue of dogma. We are not Catholics. We never had that kind of dogma. I believe with all my heart that the Torah is a divine document. That without a question. But there are many ways of explaining even the documentary hypothesis. There was a very great theologian, Rav Mordechai Breuer, who taught at Yeshivat Har Etzion, and he believed that there were those 4 documents, different documents. The law has to be understood. It has to be taken, you know, these are very fascinating issues, but not fundamental issues to Judaism. I certainly agree. I think that anyone who looks around, and especially if they visited Israel, and looks at Jewish history, and looks at the promises that God makes, that im yeni dechacha b'kzei ha-shamayim, misham yikabetzcha Hashem Elokecha, misham yikachecha, God said that even if you gathered to the ends of the heavens, and God never promised us a rose garden, b'chukotai and kitavo, there are 2 tochechot, klalot, within the Bible. We understand very well that we would have a tough time. But the ultimate promise that God made, that even if we're gathered to the end of scattered to the ends of the heavens, God will return us to Israel. And we look around the world and history, world history, and there has never been a nation that left its homeland for 200 years and returned to that homeland. And we were scattered from our homeland for 2,000 years, and we returned in accordance with God's promise. I think if you take a look at what's going on today in Israel, I think you have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to believe that the Torah is a divine document. But it's not the matter of dogma. It's much more profound than that.
If I can ask Rev Riskin, what did Rev Soloveitchik say about the Shalosha Asari Karim? Did he also felt that it was not accepted?
You know, I studied with the Rev for 7 years, and afterwards I spent a great deal of time meeting with him. I don't think these were fundamental things to him. He says that too in the beginning of The Lonely Man of Faith. He said, oh, no, these were not the issues that that he took up. These were not the issues that were crucial to him. the existential issues of humanity and loneliness and, you know, finding God and meeting God and speaking to God. These were the issues. Not this. Mm-hmm. Really not this. But the second thing that interested me, what Rabbi Kelman said, that the most important thing to them, modern Orthodox Jews, was Jewish community. And I like that. I'll tell you one of the many, many things I learned living in Israel. When I came to Israel, and all of my teachings was the importance of halacha. Obviously, that's what we learned from the Rav, and I still believe very much in the cardinal importance of halacha. But then I met Sephardi Jewry. And they are 60. How many Sephardi am I here?
Wow.
That also says a lot.
No, we hired them for the occasion.
I think if we would have had this in Montreal, it would have been a different kind of audience. But what I learned from this Friday is very interesting. First of all, my own experience. I just want to say one thing about the very stirring words of Rabbi Strachler. I think we really do have a crisis. I mean, I don't think that we can afford to be complacent if 71% out of 90% of the Jews are intermarrying and assimilating out. Maybe we're not to that extent, but you know, it happens to us eventually. And there's more intermarriage now amongst the Orthodox. It's happening. From where I'm sitting, it's really happening. So I think we cannot be complacent. I mean, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelaz, eh? It's our problem. We can't just say that we're okay if the train is going off from the station to such an extent with so many Jews. But I noticed something very fascinating. In terms of Jewish youth that I know, when they go off the derech in Chutz La'aretz, it's different in Israel because they're still Jewish and there's a lot of room to come back. And in many cases, that's my experience. They sometimes go to the army, they take off a little bit from Judaism, and then they come back to Judaism. You're living in Israel, it's a Jewish country, you can't escape it. But as far as America is concerned, they go off, they really go off. And they go off all the way. And especially if they intermarry, they truly go off all the way. Amongst the Sephardim, that's not the case. Even those who don't remain Orthodox, a plata, they certainly have a plata on Shabbos. Tarat HaMishpacha, at least when they're planning on having children, the women go to the mikveh. The ones who look least likely to be interested in mikveh. They come and ask me a shayla in Tarat HaMishpacha about a mikveh, and I look at the apparel, or I don't look at the apparel, because I can't look at the apparel. I'm shocked at the questioner and the question. And they have very strong feelings about these fundamental things like God and the Torah being a divine document. And I realize that for Sephardi Jewry, halacha is not the magic word, but family is the magic word. And it's the family Shabbos, and it's the family Yom Tov, which is so fundamental. And just like they never walk out of family completely, They also don't walk out of the Yiddishkeit, which is part and parcel of family completely. And that's a secret that I think I like. When you say it's community, that's another way of saying family. And that's what makes their Judaism Judaism. I don't find this disturbing at all. I think it's wonderful, and it's even exceedingly healthy.
Rabbi Strachler?
So I just want to speak in defense of doubt. I agree with everything that my colleagues and my rabbanim said. But the way that these surveys are often phrased is sort of like, what do you believe today? And we have to recognize that faith and doubt are not black and white, and that's true for each of us in our souls, that there are times that we believe more, there are times that we believe less. And I find that as Jews, the ability to live with doubt is something which is essential to what it is that we teach, that we teach faith, and we teach faith living in comfort with the questions that that doubt brings forward. Now we're going to read in this next Shabbos about Avraham Avinu, and it's challenging a Kadosh Baruch Hu about, Shofet Kol Ha'aretz Lo Ya'aseh Mishpat. Now that's a doubt. That's a question about God. And we all have questions about God, and how we interpret and understand what those questions mean does not mean that we are out without faith. And so I would be very cautious about throwing around statistics that say that most Jews don't believe in God. I think that it's more complex than that. But even if we accept that, I think that I'll quote from the Medrash Eicha Rabba. Now, I don't actually know this by heart, and I have a search function on my phone that allows me to look up sources, so don't think that I'm so smart. So this is from Medrash Eicha Rabba. Ve'osi azavu ve'estorasi lo shamaru, quoting from Yirmiyahu. Halavai osi azavu sorasi shamaru. Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if only they gave up on me and still kept the Torah. Mitoch shayu mis'askim ba, hama'or sheba haya machziran lamutav. If they only kept the Torah and they studied the Torah, even they didn't believe in God, even they rejected God, even they filled out the survey and said, I don't believe in God, but they still studied and lived Torah, it'd be okay. Why? Because the light of the Torah would bring them back to the good. Rav Huna Amar, Lama Torah, Afapi Shalol Lishma, Shemitok Shalol Lishma Balishma. To live a Jewish life, Shalol Lishma, is still okay. Because Shemitok Shalol Lishma, Balishma. From starting off with it about being the way that it's supposed to be, not doing it with full faith, the Torah brings us back. That our ma'asim pull our levavot, they pull our hearts. And that we should have confidence in community, have confidence in Torah, despite surveys.
Thank you. Okay, so Rabbi Riskin, you mentioned that the number two issue, or the second major issue besides intermarriage, is women leadership, women spiritual leadership. I might as well address that issue briefly. And I guess I'm concerned this is going to lead to a schism within Orthodoxy. As I'm sure many of you know, the OU recently issued a statement that signed by seven very important rabbis, that women in rabbinic positions are totally not allowed. And the OU is considering expelling those shuls that have women who in rabbinic leadership, and you, Rabbi Riskin, are involved in promoting women's rabbinic leadership in Israel. And the survey, whether you think the scientific, we won't get into that now, but that was clearly the issue where the widest range of opinion, the open Orthodox very much in support, the right-wing Orthodox is very much against, and although 53% of overall are interested in some form of rabbinic leadership, so I guess I want to ask all the rabbis, Rabbi Riskin, to deal with that issue in terms of women rabbis and why you think that's, how you think on the position, and I'd like Rabbi Strachler and Rabbi Karofkin to deal with the issue on the American side in the shuls here, how big an issue, what role do we give women, what role can we give women, what are the limits, and what do we do about that? I'll give you 3.5 minutes each. Okay. Well, extend. I won't look at my watch. We'll start with Rabbi Riskin, since you were the one who raised the issue.
First of all, it's not an issue at all in Israel. We give smicha, heter hora'ah, to women. We were the first to do it. There are many other Rosh Yeshiva who do it in Israel. Amongst the most well-known and most impressive. I've given smicha to granddaughters of major Rosh Yeshiva, and they all came to the graduations and applauded getting of Heter Hora'a. In Israel, it's just not an issue. We have two women who wrote an excellent sefer of responsa and difficult halachic issues that they took up in the book of Tshuvot, Shailot to Tshuvot. And it was discussed again by rabbinic leaders very positively and no difficulty, without any kind of difficulty. So that it's not an issue in Israel. It's a non-issue in Israel. I'm not quite sure I understand why it should be such an issue in America. Having said what I've said, however, I am against women rabbis, calling them rabbis. I am against women presiding, being the major individual, religious individual, presiding over a synagogue. And the reason is very clear, because synagogues were created initially as the place for kriyat haTorah berabim, public Torah reading, and public prayers. And women cannot recite public prayers for men and women, in my humble opinion, or not so humble opinion. And women cannot read the Torah for men and women because they are not obligated in public Torah reading and public prayer. And therefore, they cannot discharge women of that obligation. So if you call a woman, and in many synagogue situations, it's expected that the rabbi is going to do that, especially within the Eidot HaMizrach. The rabbi is usually the Baal Koreh. And if a woman is called rabbi like a man is called rabbi, it might be thought that she would certainly be able to do that for a congregation. And I don't believe she would be able to do that for a congregation. So I'm against the partnership minyanim in that sense. So therefore, I wouldn't call her rabbi or rabbah.
What do you call her?
I suggested manigot, but they themselves, in many instances, in just about most instances, rabbaniot, rabbanit. And that's fine, I feel that's fine, because that's not necessarily a male rabbi, you know, in that sense. But, so I feel very strongly on two issues. Number one, a woman can certainly get heter hora'ah. I don't even call it smicha. In deference to my colleagues in America, I don't even call it smicha, because smicha usually is used for synagogue leadership. So I don't even call it smicha, but I very proudly call it heter hora'ah. And I believe with all my heart that not to do this, there are two major revolutionary educational changes that happened since the Holocaust in terms of Torah learning. Number one, Daf Yomi, where there are so many balabatim learning Gemara, it's magnificent, just magnificent, a glory to behold. And the second is women learning Torah Shebaal Peh. And we will lose the best women we have if we don't allow them to go all the way. And I am certain that Rabbi Soloveitchik would agree with me.
If I can be a mechutzef, it was just announced in the media that Rav Riskin will be stepping down at some point in the near future from the Or Torah Institutes.
Or Torah Stone.
The Or
Not
Torah Stone.
Stepping down from the Or Torah Institutes, but stepping down from being the responsible person.
The responsible person.
For the education and all of the, for the educational institutions. We have Baruch Hashem, 24 schools and 11 campuses and a very, very big budget. So I in a year, Be'ezrat Hashem, I will not be the one responsible for all of this. I will still be teaching, and I'll still be a Rosh Yeshiva there, but I won't be responsible.
So the chutzpahdika question is, our dear chaver, Rabbi Kenny Brander from the Center of the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University, was announced as the successor of the of Rev Riskin's position.
Proudly.
Yes. And the big question is, will he give Heter Hora like Rev Riskin has?
There is no question that the answer is yes. I would never have appointed him, and I would never have taken him. And I would add, I'm surprised you even asked the question, I'll tell you. One of the reasons, Baruch Hashem, nobody forced me to make this statement. I want more time to write, and I want more time to teach. And therefore, I was the one who suggested that I wanted someone else to take over that responsibility. And I was very instrumental. In fact, it was my initial appointment. And of course, this means a great deal to me. I believe very strongly, I mean, that's one of the revolutions that we did in Israel, was women studying Torah Sheba'al Peh on the highest of levels. And women in yeshivot is there in the highest of levels. And this is one of the revolutions. And certainly, I feel strongly that he will continue. Otherwise, as I said, there would never have been the appointment.
Okay, you heard it here first. Rabbi,
you want to comment on the schism issue? Because the woman issue is such a, it is an issue here for sure in America.
So first of all, I mean.
Here in America?
And Canada, yeah. I'm sorry.
Do you disagree, Rabbi Kropkin, that women should be able to have heter hora?
First of all, it's a very interesting question. You know, the truth of the matter is, I am in awe of Rev Riskin. So for me to even have a different daya in his presence is very difficult. I challenge anyone to identify someone who has done more for Klal Yisrael as a rabbi than Rabbi Riskin has done in his illustrious career. And so with that in mind, far be it for me to say I agree or I disagree. It's an absurdity. I will say this. I believe that it's easier to pull off in Israel, and perhaps it's semantics, perhaps it's the social structures that differentiate, that are different in Israel from the way they are in the United States. Ordination means being a rabbi here, and I guess maybe.
So I don't use the term. I don't use ordination. I don't use smicha. But I do say heter hora.
Right.
That's an achievement in Torah, in Torah Sheba'al Peh, especially. Yeah,
listen, I certainly believe that there should be an acknowledgement of a person, male or female, of having achieved a certain level of scholarship and having reached a certain level of a madrega of sorts. But we don't have something like that here. I don't know whether it's going to happen or not. And it's certainly not something that is for me to decide whether it should or should not happen. I don't even think that was even part of the OU position paper, whether there can be heter hora'ah, which is really sort of like it's nishtahi nishtaher, in the mind, I guess, of a very black and white kind of thinking. You're either a rabbi or you're not a rabbi. So what Rev Riskin has created in a very elegant fashion, I would add, is a sort of a recognition, some kind of a diploma, some kind of honorific title that is neither rabbi nor non-rabbi. And it's, again, something for us to discuss. I don't know. I will say this. I am very pleased that Rev Riskin is in accord in spirit and according to his view that women should not preside over a synagogue. This is the real issue, I believe, that the OU position paper was addressing.
I agree.
By the way, the OU just came out right before Shabbos with the opening of the Department of Women's Initiatives. Because the OU, you know, they should have done this before they came out with the position paper, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu Makdim Refuah Lamaka. Hashem usually brings the cure before the disease. But the OU brought the disease and then they realized it had to bring the refuah also. This is a way of creating, and perhaps maybe one of the results of the Department of Women's Initiatives will to be provide some kind of diploma of recognition to women who reach a certain plateau of Torah Sheba'al Peh scholarship. I don't know. Maybe that will be one of their issues. Look, many of you know that I'm extremely open to constantly expanding the role of women in an Orthodox synagogue. I need guidance from the women in our shul, and if anything, you know, a rabbi cannot run more than two or three paces ahead of his kehila, right? If the rabbi tries to run ahead of the kehila too far, he'll be lost. So in that sense, if the kehila is ready for introducing new programs and roles and things like that, that's a discussion that we have to have as a community. And it's not, I don't think it's for the rabbi of the community to say, we're going to do a new initiative if the community's not ready for it. So that's really a conversation that has to be bilateral between the kehila and the leadership, the rabbinic leadership. Quite simply, I mean, I guess maybe I'll stop here. There's a lot to discuss. I gave a shiur that many of you remember, one Tikkun Leil Shavuos, about why women are not called up to the Torah. It's the same reason why women cannot stand up in front of the kahal and preside over services as well. In my opinion, it's got to do with this issue called Kavod HaTzibur, which we'll talk about another time. It'll open up a whole can of worms. For Rabbi Strauchler.
I would quote Herzl, but try to change it just a little bit, which is, if you will it, it is not a schism. And I think that it's important to remember that whatever the Orthodox Union does, the Orthodox Union is not orthodoxy. And the Orthodox Union is a kashrus organization. And I think that we need to start saying this now just in case. So we need to be very clear that it's how we treat one another that's going to determine whether we're going to split apart or not. And that's the job of each of us as rabbis, of each of us as Jews within our community, how we treat one another. And the ability to accept differences of opinion, to be able to be many people with many different views, but still be able to sit at each other's Shabbos tables, to daven next to one another, it's going to be that's going to determine whether we break apart or not. There are forces that within our community that I think the survey tried to almost bring out and create many modern orthodoxies and breaking us up into five different groups. And it isn't entirely possible that these five groups could shatter and come apart into different ways, but I don't think they have to. There's so many forces within our society that are pulling us apart right now in all sorts of different ways, in politics, in economics, in all sorts of ways, but it doesn't have to happen here. And I would see it really as a call to us as leaders and also to us as a community as a whole to ask ourselves what language we use in referring to one another when we have our conflicts, and we're always gonna have conflicts. What language do we use when we speak about the other person in our conflicts? Because every shul is gonna have this side and that side and the other side, and every community is gonna have that. But the language that we use is gonna be crucial in terms of whether we have that schism or not. And the other point I would add just as a person who's sensitive to Jewish history, which is that in Jewish history, it's very difficult to throw anybody out. When we have schisms, when Jews come apart, it's typically when somebody leaves. And that's going to be the key point. We make it impossible for others to stay within our community. And so I don't think that the Orthodox Union has the power to determine who's Orthodox and who's not Orthodox, nor do I think that it would be an act of exclusion that would be the final bell that would push somebody out. It's only going to happen when Jews who are currently part of our communities decide, you know what, I don't want to be here anymore. That's how schisms happen. And I pray that it not happen, and I'm trying to do everything that I can, as I'm sure my colleagues are, to make sure that it not happen.
Thank you. If I could just
Just a quick comment. I'm sorry, I don't mean to monopolize. Rabbi Strachler, I agree with the sentiment of everything that you said. I just have to take issue respectfully with one thing you said, that the OU is only a kashrus organization. I don't agree with that. I think the OU does wield more power than that. The Rabbinical Council of America, that all of us are members of, actually turned to the OU to commission a response because we felt it was too hot for us to touch. As a fraternal order of rabbis, since many of our members of our fraternal order do believe in women's smicha, women becoming rabbis, and therefore we sort of passed the football or passed the hot potato to the OU. The OU then commissioned these Rashi yeshiva from Yeshiva University. So there is sort of a triangle of the OU, the RCA of YU, that form the leadership arms of modern orthodoxy. I do believe it would be a mistake for the OU to sort of just reject these congregations out of hand. That's where we agree. But if the OU were to do that, it would be tragic, but it would have very serious repercussions.
Rabbi Bakasha.
Yeah, I would only want to add one thing. First of all, if you look within the Shulchan Aruch as what smicha is, the Ramah paskins in the Shulchan Aruch that smicha today is netilat rishut ba'alma latet halachik psak. It's the permission given a student by his teacher to give halachic direction. Nothing to do about presiding over a synagogue. In other words, when I speak about heter hora'ah and the halachic material that we have, the Rivash agrees with the Ramah, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of halachic material here. This is what it is. If you allow a woman to teach Torah, you have to allow her, I think, to also give piskei halacha. Rav Bakshi Doron has an open tshuva that a woman can be a gedolat hador and a woman can give psakim. In other words, in the halakhic world, it doesn't mean presiding over a synagogue. I don't use the term smicha because it's come to mean that in America. Doesn't mean that in Israel either. But it never meant that halakhically. And therefore, I think it's wrong to say that it's prohibited. Heter hora'ah certainly, because there's nothing in halacha which would permit it, which would prohibit it. Now, the most important thing that I really would like to say, in along with what Rabbi Strachler had said, is this. One of the things that I love about modern orthodoxy, and my problem with the chief rabbinate today in Israel, which is Haredi, is that for me the most important principle in the Talmud is being overlooked. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. There's a legitimacy within the Talmud to differing opinions in halacha. Obviously, halacha has a structure. You can be beyond the pale, but within the pale, Giur, there was the view of Beit Hillel and there was the view of Beit Shammai. And they lived alongside of each other for many, many, many generations. And the Mishnah in Chagiga even said they intermarried with each other and they ate in each other's homes, even though one had a Giur according to Beit Hillel and one had a Giur according to Beit Shammai. In other words, there's a pluralism within Orthodoxy. That's what I love about modern Orthodox, and that's why I associate as being modern Orthodox. Now, for example, in the area of Giur and Zera Yisrael, I'm not going to get into that now. In Israel, it's a very big issue. But the chief rabbinate wanted to close down my conversion court. And on this basis, and I said, you want to call a hearing? I'm willing to have any hearing. I have never paskined a giur, not in accordance with one of the former chief rabbis in Israel. I don't agree with you, the present Haredi chief rabbis, because I think you're wrong in terms of how you look at Zera Yisrael. But I'm in accordance with Mishpatei Uziel and Rav Herzog and Rav Gorin and a whole history of chief rabbis in Israel. And therefore, and the Supreme Court gave me right, said that's fine, that's okay, that's correct. I have every right to continue my conversion court. So, and we have now five conversion courts that go along. We're called Giur Kahalacha. We're under Rav Nachum Eliezer Rabinovich, who's a wonderful Talmud Chacham, and he's the our Nasi, and works out very, very well. But Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chaim is very important. And I don't think that for what they might call, what someone might call halachic ethos, they would shut someone out from orthodoxy. I agree very strongly that no one has the right to shut someone else out from orthodoxy, especially if their position has basis within halacha.
About 75 years ago, there were a number of tshuvas, maybe 100 years ago, a number of tshuvas that were written about the microphone on Shabbos. And there was a minority opinion of very, very learned and orthodox rabbanim who permitted the use of the microphone on Shabbos. And as a result, these shuls were had full mechitzas, davened according to halacha, but the rav gave a drasha with a microphone. Up until maybe 30, 40 years ago, this was a widespread phenomenon. And many, many large cities had orthodox shuls with a microphone. The OU came up with a decision about 25 years ago, maybe a little bit less than that, that while their policy had been to allow shuls with a microphone to be to remain as orthodox shuls, they were not going to accept any more orthodox shuls with microphones, and they were going to slowly phase out those three or four shuls left in North America that had a microphone. And that's actually what's happened. It's the shuls that were grandfathered were allowed to stay until eventually enough slow and subtle pressure was put upon them to pull out, and they eventually, of their own volition, pulled out of the Orthodox Union. Unfortunately, I don't see that same wisdom emerging from the OU to, let's say, grandfather these four congregations that are in question, and to be able to gently and subtly work with them in the way that was done with the microphone. That's the analogy that I would say, is that at some point there has to be a cutoff on either end of what the boundaries of halakha are. And if there comes to be a psak that a woman rabbi on staff in a shul is not considered acceptable to the Orthodox Union, which is what the Orthodox Union has essentially said, it's a mistake to exclude them and cut them out, but they have to be grandfathered in for a certain period of time. That's what I would say.
And after that time, they're out of orthodoxy?
I don't know. Let's wait and see where they are. You know, no one has a crystal ball.
Okay. There's a lot more to discuss. What I promise we'll leave a few minutes for questions. So if we'll do that for 10 or 15 minutes. I ask you to ask a question, 30 seconds or less, no statements, please. If you go to the microphone, and then we'll try to take two or three questions, and then we'll call it an evening, and to be continued at another time and date, and maybe with other speakers.
I have a very brief question. I have been blessed with two grandchildren, teenage grandchildren living with me, and you talked about why be Jewish. So it's our social justice, it's our moral determination according to halacha. The buzzword today is moral equivalency. Everybody tries to make the world a better place. In my day it was, I'm okay, you're okay. How do we fight that kind of sentiment that everybody's trying to make the world a good place? What's so special about us?
Okay, why don't we take all the questions in one round so we can answer them in one round to just for time constraints. Yeah, please.
Thank you. I believe there are some shuls that have women as yoetzet halacha because some women may feel more comfortable asking a woman certain questions than going directly to the rabbi. And I believe these women probably have some sort of heter hara, and when it's something they don't know, I'm sure they will consult with the rabbi. So what is your view on women in a shul as you atzot halakha?
Well, just we can answer that. You know, in Toronto, I know you're visiting from out of town, but in Toronto, we've just launched under the banner of Mizrahi, the community-wide Yo Atzot Halakha program. And both Shari Shamayim and Bayit and other shuls are very proud participants of the Yo Atzot Halakha program. So we definitely acknowledge and recognize the need for there to be women who can answer she'elot for women who don't feel, and especially since many of them don't feel comfortable going to the rabbi.
Bakasha.
My question is more or less the same as the first lady that spoke. Rabbi Riskin, you mentioned about the reason to be Jewish is to improve, change the world. And I think of all the secular Jews that I cross paths with, and they're really big on social justice. And that's not enough to keep their children Jewish. Their children are intermarrying. What more is there?
Okay. Thank you. Next, please. Thank you.
I know you've sort of dismissed dogma as a much of a secondary issue, but the one I'm asking in particular, and I think this panel is absolutely the best qualified to answer this, because you have, at least I know two of you, have really understand, you have been, you were a Rhodes Scholar, you're getting your PhD from UCLA. Not the straw man that you've set up about this chassid, but something real, in that you understand the rigor and the integrity of biblical scholarship in academic level. And I'm sure you do, not the straw man of some chassid. And as I'm sure you're also well aware, that the overwhelming consensus, more than there's consensus about evolution or anything else, is that from their rigorous integrity study, that the Tanakh is reliable as a historical source from King David's grandson, Rehoboam. And how does Orthodox Judaism, which has an honest and honest respect for scholarship, whether it's scientific or this sort of scholarship, how do we respond to that? And maybe as a, it's a corollary to that, how do you respond to what, and we're all talking about surveys, but the Pew survey, which everybody says is super scientific, that a very a large minority of people who identify as Orthodox, they said maybe 20%, basically practice orthopraxis. And how do we respond to that?
Thank you. Okay, last two questions.
What do you mean by orthopraxis?
They don't believe in the fundamentals of belief, but they follow halakha in practice. Social orthodoxy, what we would call social orthodoxy. Okay, last two questions, and then we'll open up to the panel.
Rabbi Riskin, you mentioned the high intermarriage rate, and obviously we need to have Jewish families to continue our Orthodox Judaism. So what do you think, and I'm asking all three of you, what can the communities do to reduce the intermarriage rate? Because what we've been doing up to now is obviously not working. The intermarriage rate keeps increasing, and it seems to be a very low priority for rabbinim in the community. And we have so many shuls and community organizations that are really not reaching out with the shidduch crisis. They pay a lot of lip service, they have parlor meetings, and they get together and they talk, but there's no concrete results. And I think this is one of the biggest problems facing the future of Orthodox Judaism. If we do not help with the shidduch crisis, and we do not help have more Jewish marriages. Thank you.
Okay. Last question.
My name is David Misha. I live in the Reno home in the community living. I do a lot of mitzvah. I want to thank Robert Krabin when he told me many times we should love all the Jews. Because why we, today he said something this morning. Why are we Jewish? Because we like them. We don't judge them. We appreciate them. We love them. Because the Jews doesn't know no matter what they did.
David, you're the best.
I thank Robert Krabin. Mashiach is coming.
You're the best. We love you, Dave.
Okay, so if you can address some, all, or as many as you'd like, and we'll go through and we'll call it an evening afterwards. We'll start with Rabbi Strachler. Go in reverse order.
The question in regards to moral equivalence, although I think it was primarily asked towards Rabbi Riskin, Judaism's approach to improving the world as a nation, as a people, and it's not simply that we as individuals go and improve the world, but rather that Kadosh Baruch Hu has given us a brit, a covenant, in which we work together as a community to make the world better. And so it is crucial that we not just speak about tikkun olam, but rather that we speak about Judaism working together and preserving the values of Judaism and utilizing that as a tool through which to achieve the mission of Avraham Avinu that we read about this morning. In regards to dogma and the issues of biblical criticism, I think that there is certainly much to study in these fields, and I think that al regel achat, it would be difficult to try to address all the different pieces by which they could threaten a person's emuna. But all to say that I don't believe that with all those questions together that a person cannot have emuna. And that the critique of biblical scholarship as a tool can never bring out the issues of which emuna is really founded upon, which is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists, that God exists, and that we as mankind are mitzuveh, that we feel God's command as something that changes how we live and directs our lives. And so the issues of biblical criticism are serious. They're really worthy of conversation, but I don't think that they're relevant to the key questions of a community's emuna. In regards to the intermarriage rate and the shidduch crisis, I think that this is something that we're doing every day to work on. I think that the work that we're doing to build community, to raise children who care about Torah and mitzvos, is the magic formula that which I spoke earlier, is that the Jewish communities that we build, that we spend all our time, energy, and resources to make sure that they're thriving, that is the way in which, for the first time in North American history, we are producing more Jews in the next generation than the past generation. And when, if we're going to truly confront the challenge of continuity, it is by growing what we're doing well. And it's by bringing people under our banner, saying to those who care about Jewish continuity, if you want to have Jewish grandchildren, this is where it's happening. Now, there's always more to do better. We cannot say that any given family who has a child who's not married, we have to do what we can, because it is a crisis that is a problem. If any Jewish family has a situation where their child is intermarrying, it is a crisis. Don't get me wrong. But we also have to recognize our successes. And if we're going to look to the Jewish world, we have something to share, which is that the basis through which you're going to see Jewish grandchildren is through commitment to halacha and to Jewish community. And we have to say that proudly.
You should give a plug for the Shabbaton next Shabbos.
Yes, and by the way, we are going to have a Shari Shemaim next Shabbos, a single Shabbaton. Please let all your singles know. We'd love for them to join. Please call Shari Shemaim if you'd like to participate.
And the Vibe will be doing a Shabbaton later in the year, God willing, also. So we try. We do try.
Rabbi Riskin, Rakesha.
Okay. Yoatzot halacha, that's the first thing. That's exactly my point, that I believe that the OU has given it pretty good marks. And if women can paskin in as Yoatzot halacha and Tarat HaMishpacha, There is absolutely no difference between paskening that and paskening Shabbos questions and other questions, and that's my position. I don't think that I got a free pass from the RCA, and I think I would get a free pass from the OU in terms of what my position is here. So I think that proves the possibility of women paskening halacha. Okay. The other questions I would like to answer together. How does being Jewish help the world? After all, that's what everybody else is saying they're doing in terms of Tikkun Olam. If a rabbi speaks about Tikkun Olam, he sounds like a Reform rabbi nowadays. And that's a pity, because it's part of Aleinu L'shaveach. But the question is a very important question. And that's bound up also with belief and emunah and the questions that you asked earlier, and how to decrease the intermarried rate. So let me say something about that and try to answer everything in one way. I think it is mere folly to think that you can decrease the intermarriage rate in a world in which the Jews are accepted as legitimate people to marry. In other words, throughout the history of Jewish diaspora, there has always been very strong statistics of assimilation and intermarriage. The only thing that prevented it in the main, two things. Number one, strong orthodoxy, which was a wall against intermarriage. Or the fact that the goyim didn't take us. We're living in America where the goyim are taking us, and aside from the Orthodox, there's no wall. We live just the way they do. So there's not a chance in America of stopping the intermarriage rate, and it's going to come to Canada also. There's not a chance. You have to understand that. But what I think you have to do is see the intermarriage rate as an opportunity and have meaningful conversion classes that are experiential. And meaningful conversion classes doesn't mean exams. It means Shabbatonim and Chagonim, and teaching people. I have a whole syllabus, we call it the romance of Judaism, and we always say that both the Jewish part and the non-Jewish part study together. We've had tremendous success, and I'm going to give just one anecdote that I gave in shul this morning in Shari Shemayim. I want to give one anecdote that I think will answer the question also about what I mean when I say make the world better in Judaism. A couple from Los Angeles, a young man who happened to have been the star of Wicked, the play in Broadway, which is a morality play, a very good play. He came from a very Jewish Zionist family, but not observant, really. And he was not observant, obviously, but he was traditional, very traditional. There was always the Shabbos meal. I think there may have even been Kiddush in the house. But Shabbos ended more or less Friday night, you know, and okay. He met a wonderful young woman who was a professional dancer. And they both attended the course that we give in Manhattan, The Romance of Judaism. When I brought the young woman before my board of my rabbinic colleagues were on my beat in, I asked first some questions and then I gave them open sesame to ask their questions. And the first question I asked the young lady was, what do you like most about Judaism? And she said, Shabbat. What do you like most about Shabbat? And she said, no telephones. Surprised me. I was very pleased. And I said, will you please explain? So she said, one of the glories of Judaism is that it understands the importance of relationships over acquisitions. Most people spend their lives searching for acquisitions. And most of us understand that, but first of all, once you acquire something you wanted, it loses its allure. And secondly, you don't acquire it for good under any circumstances. It's always temporary. Shabbat is a day that's given over to relationships rather than acquisitions. And it's a marvelous thing. She said, you know, in our present society, even two people who are engaged to be married and go out for dinner together, more often than not can be seen each one looking at their cell phone, not even looking at each other, but looking at their cell phones and talking to somebody else or wondering who else is trying to reach them at the same time. Shabbat is a day when we look at each other and relate to each other in a very positive fashion. And therefore, she feels that if you are plugged in 6 days a week, it's critical to be plugged out on the seventh day and to look at the other individual and to spend time with the other individual, with community, with God, without the acquisition of a cell phone getting in the way of the relationship. And I think Shabbat, today was the Shabbat for everyone, and Shabbat is a message to the world, and an important message to the world. In other words, I believe that Judaism teaches the importance of relationship, teaches the importance of love and peace and compassion, but gives the structure of festivals and Shabbat to enable this to be expressed and lived. And not just be a motto or a slogan that has very little to do with the way you live your life. And it's what enabled, let's say, the United Nations to write about peace, and nation shall not lift up sword against nation, and people shall not learn war anymore. It's written on the United Nations wall, but everyone who follows the United Nations knows very well that they're the disunited nations, and they are very antithetical to peace, and they're even in many ways encouraging terrorism. So Judaism gives you a way of life that leads to compassionate righteousness and moral justice that must start with individuals and then hopefully will reach out to the world.
Thank you. Rabbi Karofkin.
I'll just say briefly, because the hour is late, just to respond, you know, when Rav Riskin said that the key, that what we're trying to accomplish as modern Orthodox Jews is to try to change the world, make it into a better place, he certainly wasn't saying that that's exclusively our role, and halavai, that we would really believe that that's our role. Rav Kook talks about the dichotomy that exists within
within Torah Judaism. There's the Yosef, or the Yosef in the Yehuda. The Yosef is the portion of the Jew that tries to constantly go out and make the world a better place. The Yehuda is the one who creates the walls and fortifications within the Jewish society, which creates the infrastructure. It's not a contradiction. The biggest problem that we have in the modern Orthodox world is that we were liberated from anti-Semitism largely in North America. We were liberated from the walls and the ostracizations of the outside society, and we've squandered all of these opportunities. We have such a beautiful product to share with the world, and we're keeping it within ourselves. You know, it's so hard. What we do every year now is we participate with the Reform congregation, and we feed the homeless in December for the Out of the Cold program. I can't tell you how much flack I continue to get for the fact that we participate in feeding the homeless because, oy, chas v'shalom, that an Orthodox Jew should walk into the lobby of a Reform temple and feed a hot meal to a homeless person. Well, I wish we should give them legitimacy. These are the things that we're agonizing over when we should be feeding the homeless in our own shul, and we should be going all the time and holding the banner of what it means to be a Torah Jew who's trying to make our community and all of the underprivileged in our community more enriched because of it. But we're not. We're squandering it. So the issue is not, oh, you know, if you just tell your child we're here to change the world, they're not going to want to be Jewish. Of course there's more to it than that. There's the Yosef, there's the Yehuda. We've overemphasized the Yehuda. We've got to start working on Tikkun Olam. We've got to start working on making the world a better place as well.
Thank you very much. I want to thank our wonderful panelists and wish everybody a Shavua Tov. Thank you very much.